Hello, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending on where you might be in the world. Welcome to this event hosted by the School of Public Policy at the LSE. My name is Andres Velasco, and I am the Dean of the school. Very, very pleased to be chairing this event today and happy to be welcoming our two guests, Eric Protzer and Paul Somerville, and also to be joined by my LSE colleague, Vanessa Rubio. Before I introduce speakers, let me just make a couple of announcements. First of all, I suspect some of you in the audience may be using Twitter, and the hashtag for today is LSE Populism, of course, preceded by the hashtag sign. This event is being recorded. We will make it into a podcast, presuming no technical difficulties arise. In terms of format, we're going to follow a very simple format. The speakers will make initial presentations. So then I will use my chair's privilege to ask a question or two. And of course, we will have some remarks before my questions. From Vanessa, who will be our discussant slash respondent. And then we will make sure that we have enough time to accommodate and address the questions that are brought up by you, our audience. When you do, you know, try to keep the questions short, please, and also let us know your name and affiliation. So the subject matter of today, of course, is populism. How can economic fairness win back disenchanted voters? And I like, you know, the idea of reclaiming populism, reclaiming democracy, perhaps, away from populists. I can think of a few subject matters that are so important today across the world in the realm of both politics and public policy. And to address those issues and tell us about the book that they have written together, we have Paul Somerville, who is an adjunct professor in the School of Business at the University of Victoria. Paul has a PhD in international relations, and in addition to a 20-year career in finance in Australia, he also ran for parliament. He co-founded an e-commerce firm and served on the board of the Canada Revenue Agency. Eric Protzer is a research fellow at the Kennedy School at the Growth Lab within the Harvard Kennedy School, and he has a master's degree from MIT in technology policy. Eric's work has been cited and featured in reports by the UN, the IMF, the Inter-American Development Bank, and the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. And he has worked with and advised governments in Western Australia, Jordan, and Colombia, among others. He's particularly interested in the application of data science techniques to policy problems and the impact of technology on the economy. My colleague, Vanessa Rubio, is a professor of practice here at the School of Public Policy. And she came to us from her native Mexico, where she had a very, very distinguished career in public policy formulation and public service. She was a senator, she ran a presidential campaign, and in addition to that, she was the deputy minister of finance in Mexico, the deputy minister of social development, and of foreign affairs. So extraordinary and diverse experiences in sort of all key subcategories, if you want to think about it that way, of public policy. So without further ado, let me just say that you can order the book Reclaiming Populism from our official LSE Events independent bookshop, Pages of Hackney. You can find a link to it in the chat. So let's jump into the subject matter of this. I'm going to hand it over to Eric and to Paul, then we will ask Vanessa for comments, and then we will enter a dialogue with the audience. So thank you very much, and over to you guys.
Well, thank you very much. Eric and I would like to thank you for joining us to help launch our new book, Reclaiming Populism, How Economic Fairness Can Win Back Disenchanted Voters, published by Policy Books. We'd also like to thank Andres for the invitation and for chairing the launch, Vanessa for joining us in a discussion of the book, and Carolina, who is in Argentina right now, for all the technical support. There are a number of issues that reclaiming populism raises. However, for our presentation today, we want to focus on an analysis of what causes populism and what can be done about it. Eric and I started working on reclaiming populism over 3 years ago, but we soon discovered that the existing political debate did not adequately speak to economic fairness the way that most citizens understand it. Consequently, the mainstream was unable to respond positively and in fact made things worse, while the enemies of liberal democracy pounced. Our book shows that a combination of policy failures have in key countries both weakened the extent to which opportunity is equal and reward is according to contribution. Two important consequences are low social mobility and high vulnerability to economic shocks. This understanding is at the heart of the populist challenge because it invalidates the most popular explanations for the success of modern day populists, namely income inequality and immigration. Our book asks, what can policymakers and politicians do about this? We argue that to rebuild fair, socially mobile economies, they must embrace the twin virtues of equal opportunity and fair, unequal outcomes. Specifically, our book demonstrates that on the whole, people are deeply opposed to equalized outcomes, but prize fair, unequal outcomes. We argue that capitalism is at the core of successful democracies, essential to high levels of social mobility, as well as a key tool for funding the core pillars of equal opportunity. At the same time, we argue capitalism is not a uniform thing. Capitalism is what you make of it, which helps to explain the diversity of national outcomes for better or worse. Thus, capitalism can be a vehicle for gross inequality and economic unfairness, as much as a vehicle for highly mobile and economically fair societies. It is therefore vital to differentiate equal opportunity from equal outcomes, which are far too often incorrectly conflated. Opportunity is greatly a function of what a society provides so that citizens can live their lives as much as possible on their own terms. Outcomes are the consequence of the pursuit of those life chances. Millions and millions and millions of people pursuing their own paths will, by any understanding of the human condition, inevitably result in very, very unequal outcomes. This is a good thing, provided, of course, those outcomes are achieved fairly. Finally, it cannot be overstated that those hoping to reclaim the disenchanted voter must get off the bandwagon of equal outcomes and social justice, focusing instead on economic fairness and social mobility. Eric will now present our findings.
Thanks, everybody. And thanks very much for the introductions from Andres and Paul. And welcome also to Vanessa joining us here. I'd like to run you through quickly the agenda for the presentation today. First, we're going to give a brief overview of the book. Then we're going to delve into the book's main arguments. First, how economic unfairness leads to populism, the policy inputs to a fairer economy, and how to diagnose constraints to social mobility, which are different for different countries. And then we'll end with a brief conclusion with some of the key lessons. To begin, let's give an overview of what the book is about. Now, the typical book on populism cites how worrisome its political leaders are, like some of the gentlemen seen on the right here, and offers some sort of long-standing political concern to explain voters' motives. For example, there being too many poisonous ideas in society, or too many foreigners, or too much income and wealth inequality. We want to emphasize that reclaiming populism sharply diverges from this existing conversation. We argue that the extant debate fails to capture the legitimate economic unfairness citizens are really angry at, and how that is different from simple income and wealth inequality. In addition, we offer detailed and actionable policy advice to fix the root issues behind populism. All being told, reclaiming populism argues that populism strikes hardest when the economy is unfair. It contends that a fair and socially mobile economy is possible through equal opportunity and fair unequal outcomes. And it shows how to diagnose which missing policy inputs most hold back and constrain social mobility in a given country. Now, in order to substantiate that, let's turn to the first part of the argument, how economic unfairness leads to populism. The causal model we have in mind here is, as shown here, it begins with a pool of policy failures that are different depending on the country in question, which lead to economic unfairness, which what we're referring to as economic unfairness here is comprised of opportunity being less equal and reward being less according to contribution. That kind of structural economic unfairness in society in turn has important consequences. It creates persistently low social mobility, and it creates high vulnerability to economic shocks, so that on the whole, citizens have a hard time getting ahead if they come from a position, a precarious economic position. They have a hard time getting ahead on their own merits. And in turn, that leads to the perception of an unfair system in need of forceful correction, perhaps, and thereby populism. In order to substantiate why we should believe that model is perhaps credible, we need to think of these different parts of the argument one at a time. So let's start with why we think citizens ought to be sensitive to the concern of economic unfairness as described here. Now, there is strong evidence that people care quite a lot, in fact, about economic fairness in particular. And importantly, that fair economic outcomes are very different from whether economic outcomes are simply equal or unequal. That may seem like somewhat of an obtuse statement because those ideas tend to get conflated a lot in popular discussion. So as a reason to take it seriously, here's a quote from Angus Deaton, a Nobel laureate in economics, where he wrote that inequality is not the same thing as unfairness. And to my mind, it is the latter that has incited so much political turmoil in the rich world today. Some of the processes that generate inequality are widely seen as fair, but others are deeply and obviously unfair and have become a legitimate source of anger and disaffection. So it's very important to differentiate between those equal economic outcomes and the fairness of equal opportunity and reward according to contribution. And once you do differentiate those things, there's in fact quite strong evidence, as shown by the Yale psychologists Starman, Sheskin, and Bloom, that there is no evidence that people are bothered by economic inequality itself. Rather, they are bothered by something that is often confounded or confused with inequality, economic unfairness. For example, once you separate those two concepts of fairness and equality, there's evidence that 1 to 2 year old babies expect more resources to be allocated to those who have done more work. 6-year-olds prefer to allocate more resources to someone who has done more work, even when they have the option to allocate rewards equally. And individuals surveyed across 16 different high-income countries overwhelmingly prefer an unequal distribution of economic outcomes in society, presumably because they understand that some people deserve different rewards than others. And that is hardly an outlier position in the relevant literature. This is a quote from a PhD thesis on the evolutionary origins of human fairness by Stéphane de Bove, where he wrote that it is well accepted in the behavioral sciences that people prefer income distributions with strong work salary correlations, prefer to give more to individuals whose input is more valuable, and favor meritocratic distributions as a whole in both micro and macro justice contexts. As such, there is quite strong behavioral evidence that people are sensitive to economic unfairness, in particular in a way that is different from simple income and wealth inequality. Having established that, it's necessary to next ask, well, is there any evidence that the consequences of that kind of unfairness in society actually lead to populism? And one way in which we look at that in the book through original quantitative evidence is by examining low social mobility. And when we talk about low social mobility, we're referring to a situation where in a country or in a region of a country, individual economic success strongly depends on family wealth. And that is a very clear violation of economic fairness because your family wealth, how rich your parents were, it's not an innate driver of productivity. And thus any association between that and your own success is widely seen as unfair. So reclaiming populism demonstrates that low social mobility is in fact a robust statistical predictor of the geography of contemporary rich world populism, both across and also within high-income countries. In contrast, factors like income and wealth inequality, immigration, and social media do not have the same systematic, statistically significant association. The research behind the book linking low social mobility to populism has been cited by the European Union, the United Nations, the IMF, the Inter-American Development Bank, and it's been featured by Brookings. In addition, for example, Professor Philip McCann, the man who coined the term geography of discontent, cited the research to write that social mobility is the crucial indicator of populist voting. In addition, you could look at the political effects of major economic shocks. People often talk about the global financial crisis as a major impetus to populism, and there are critical insights to be had from looking at it through the lens of fairness, insofar as people complain about purportedly corrupt elites who have created a crisis and gotten rich off it while everyone else suffers. A really interesting paper that examines that by Funke Schulerich and Trebesch looks at the impacts of financial crises from 1870 to 2014 on political extremism. And they write that on average, far-right parties increase their vote share by 30% after a financial crisis. But importantly, we do not observe similar political dynamics in normal recessions or after severe macroeconomic shocks that are not financial in nature. Now, to an economist, that ought to be a very interesting finding because you have two losses that are similar in magnitude, and yet one has very different political consequences than the other. And the authors argue, what explains the more severe political fallout after financial crises? One possibility is that non-financial downturns are seen as excusable events triggered by exogenous shocks, while financial crises may be perceived as endogenous and inexcusable, we might use the word unfair, the result of policy failures, moral hazard, and favoritism. We give plenty more evidence in the book, but this is just some of the evidence that indicates that citizens turn to populism when they are fed up with an unfair economy. They feel the system is rigged and must be forcefully reset. Other factors like social media and immigration that do not have this same systematic association have a role to play, but they're amplifiers rather than overarching chief causes, in our view. If you believe this argument is viable, naturally, the next question to pose is how can you actually construct policy inputs, or rather conceptualize policy inputs to a fairer economy? And that's this element of the causal chain here, the pool of policy failures that lead to economic unfairness to begin with. And something that we want to establish right from the get-go is that the traditional left-right discourse about, it's just big government or small government that allows people to enjoy social mobility does not stand up particularly well to the facts. This diagram here shows on the horizontal axis government spending as a share of GDP in 2019. And on the vertical axis, we've got social mobility, where countries at the top of the graph have low social mobility and countries at the bottom of the graph have high social mobility. And you can see that on the countries that suffer from low social mobility and the economic unfairness of it, they really span the whole spectrum. You have places like Switzerland, the United States, arguably even the United Kingdom, that are more representative of small government countries. And in contrast, places like Italy and especially France that have more pronouncedly large governments, and a lot of them suffer from low social mobility. And that might lead one to ask, well, if it's not just this simple left-right answer, what really are the specific policy inputs that truly underpin social mobility and economic fairness? We argue in Reclaiming Populism that the most socially mobile countries use policies that specifically enable equal opportunity and fair, unequal outcomes. Countries like Australia, Canada, and the Scandinavian countries pair state-sponsored equal opportunity with competitive markets. They are, as a consequence, socially mobile and populism resistant. You can think of how places like Australia and Canada have not had to deal with anything like the Trump phenomenon, and the Scandinavian countries, in spite of the 2015 European migrant crisis, have not had to deal with anything quite like Brexit, and even in the 2019 European Parliament election, voted for populists at rates 3 to 5 times lower than in other countries such as France, Italy, and the UK. Places that fail on either of these inputs, equal opportunity and fair unequal outcomes, in turn suffer the consequences. The US, for example, has certainly competitive market outcomes, but it has a threadbare social safety net that does not support equal opportunity. France, on the other hand, has a world-class social safety net, but it has a muddled market that regulates and taxes away the fruits of success, which make it hard for people to work their way up in their career. And as a consequence of these problems, both countries suffer from low social mobility and they house fierce populist movements. The policy inputs to equal opportunity and fair unequal outcomes in turn are themselves quite complex. We have a diagram here that has lots of things going on. I promise we're gonna break it down. But just at a first glance, you might notice that there's economic fairness here at the top, equal opportunity here on the top left, fair unequal outcomes here on the top right, and that these are in turn underpinned by a wide variety of inputs, such as equal opportunity with respect to personal characteristics like freedom from discrimination or substantive equal opportunity, the ability to become productive and access jobs, and also protection against unfair events like a financial crisis or a health downturn. But by the same token, fair unequal outcomes are vitally important. They rely on an efficient market that allows for wealth creation and value creation and rewards that, but also simultaneously punishes cheaters who would seek influence the system in a corrupt way. Now, there's a lot of things going on there, as said, but it's easier to comprehend the arguments if you imagine the life trajectory of someone who experiences social mobility personally. You can imagine someone who is, say, born into a working class family, and then they work their way up to become a middle class plumber or accountant. Doesn't matter whether they're blue collar or white collar, but the key is to ask what needs to happen along the way at every step for them to actually get that outcome. Now, the very first thing that has to happen is there has to be equal opportunity with respect to the ability to become productive through inputs like education and childhood nutrition. Now, often that constitutes the entire debate on social mobility because it's seen as so overarchingly important. But we argue that while it is important, it really shouldn't be the whole of the picture, because once somebody has gotten that productivity, that education or human capital, they then have to be able to actually access hubs of economic opportunity, where you have relevant policy inputs that include housing and transport infrastructure, things that have featured heavily in the leveling up discussion in the United Kingdom and the unequal opportunity of various regions of the country, for example. Once someone has gotten an education, being able to access physically those hubs of opportunity, that economy must be able to actually offer ample job and business opportunities. And that in turn is only possible with fair unequal outcomes that are undergirded by a competitive private sector, which is the only way to substantively reward value creation at a massive scale. That's something that is often not part of the social mobility discussion, but we do argue that it is vitally important to have competitive markets to enable social mobility. In turn, when somebody is then competing for one of those opportunities, say a job or starting a business, they have to be able to do so in a way that is free from discrimination, both in law and also in culture, so that it happens in practice. And the competition process has to be free from the influence of economic cheaters who might take away opportunities in unfair ways. You can imagine that it's no good to start a business up next door to, say, a monopolist or a business that undercuts safety standards when you're trying to really just create value and get rewarded for that. The entire way that occurs, the state has an important role in minimizing the chance of society-wide unfair events like financial crises, maybe even pandemics. And at the same time, it has to ensure against unavoidable unfair events like ill health or a job loss in a cyclical downturn. And that's where important inputs like universal healthcare or unemployment insurance have a key role to play. Collectively, as such, we argue in the book that there are multitudinous complementary policy inputs to social mobility. And because there are so many complementary inputs, very few countries, in fact, are able to enjoy high social mobility because it requires getting all those things right. Here's just the diagram again in its completeness for consideration of all the different inputs that might be relevant. Now, if you have an assessment of all the different things that might support social mobility, it's important to then turn to the question of how to diagnose what's going wrong in any particular countries. Importantly, we see these inputs to social mobility as complements and not substitutes. So what that means is that, for example, you cannot fix a terrible education system by investing more in transport infrastructure. You'd actually have to go and fix the schools. And the vice versa is true as well. And because of that, it is critical to diagnose what missing inputs most severely constrain social mobility in a given country. It's no use to spend your reform efforts and your budgets on something you're already doing pretty well on when there's some other area that you're just doing terribly on and really need to fix. The way we execute that, and we explain how to do that in the book, is by drawing on the diagnostic method. In this paper here, you'll see Velasco A is one of the authors of it, the diagnostic method practiced by Harvard University's Growth Lab, where I work. And there are a lot of different steps that go into that process, which the book goes into in detail for any policymakers that might be interested. But the core of the idea, to give just a brief taste of that, is that the most binding or severe constraints to an economic output tend to be highly desired and also scarce. And as a consequence of that, they tend to give off corresponding data signals that you can look for. So to give an example, just a very brief illustrative example, you might ask the question, does leveling up UK regional infrastructure really matter? Is this going to be, you know, a game changer for opportunity and economic fairness in the United Kingdom? Now, using that framework of searching for things that are in high demand and low supply, you might note, first of all, that the UK government has arguably undersupplied infrastructure across the nation for a couple of decades. This is a graph of the average government gross fixed capital investment, or essentially infrastructure spending, as a share of GDP among G7 countries from 1995 to 2015. And you can see that the United Kingdom is in second to last, well behind a lot of its peers. So you might draw the conclusion that infrastructure is perhaps undersupplied nationally in the United Kingdom. And on top of that, there's evidence that it is especially undersupplied regionally. Coyle and Sensier in a 2019 paper show that many infrastructure projects that were approved in London had lower cost benefit ratios than those that were turned down in British regions. As such, the limited investment in infrastructure that does occur in the UK is especially geared towards London and geared away from the regions, and thus it's doubly scarce in the regions, arguably. In addition to that, it's important to consider the demand side, not just the supply side. So for example, you might consider the fact that in a 2019 Ernst & Young survey of foreign investors, they found that transport and technological infrastructure was in fact the top decision factor for foreign investors looking to invest in UK regions, ahead even of the local availability of skills in the workforce. Now that's a fairly critical signal, because those are the kinds of investors that are looking to expand business and expand industrial industry and opportunities for people living there. And thus, that's an example of an indication that better regional infrastructure in the UK is possibly highly demanded. Collectively, then, regional infrastructure in the UK, going by those signals and even more you could search for, as we detail in the book, is in both low supply and high demand. It's therefore entirely plausible that that inadequate regional infrastructure is a binding constraint to social mobility in the UK. After identifying that kind of blockage, you might ask, well, why does that occur? It's sort of odd that there would be such a huge unaddressed problem. Is there a political economy syndrome that explains that sort of bad equilibrium? And to think about that, you might consider the fact that the United Kingdom has a very high concentration of fiscal power at the level of central as opposed to regional governments. This graph here shows on the horizontal axis the natural logarithm of population. And then on the vertical axis, it's the share of government investment that is conducted by central government. And you can see that there is no other large high-income country that does so much government spending at the level of central government other than the UK. And on the flip side, you see exactly the same pattern with regard to tax collection. Here we have, again, population on the horizontal axis, the share of taxes collected at the level of central government by country. And again, the UK is a clear outlier. And thus the fiscal powers that are so concentrated at the national level of national government may be the political economy syndrome that explains why there is so much underinvestment in the regional economies of the UK with regard to infrastructure. Importantly, this kind of diagnostic analysis can be executed both at the national and also the subnational level. It simply requires getting creative with data, interpreting signals in a Bayesian way. And again, we go into much more detail about the entire method in the book. In conclusion, Van, we want to elucidate a few clear lessons that we feel the book offers for anyone who is interested in reclaiming the populist vote for the liberal democratic mainstream. First of all, do not mischaracterize populist voters as uniformly deplorable, stupid, and racist. Populist voters notoriously complain about a rigged system, and the data in fact indicates that they have a legitimate point. It's not just that they're fed up with all the foreigners, they're fed up with not getting a fair chance at life. As a consequence of that, because populism is grounded in real economic unfairness, it cannot be simply beaten down and defeated. You can't just hope it'll go away and excoriate those who defend those views. The only option, because it is structurally entrenched, is to reclaim the populist vote for the political mainstream by substantively rectifying the very real economic unfairness that drives it. And in turn, the messaging and policy to win back the populist vote has to be very precisely targeted at a fairer economy and also the place-specific binding constraints that underpin why that country is experiencing problems with economic unfairness. Vitally, that messaging and policy cannot be confused with conflicting ideological goals, like aggressive redistribution that would unfairly equalize outcomes. We saw the evidence for that in Jeremy Corbyn's collapse in the UK, for example. And by the same token, laissez-faire neoliberalism that simply says the market is always right. You can think of the famous quote from Tony Blair, where he said, some people say we should stop and debate globalization. One might as well debate whether autumn ought to follow summer. But in fact, that ignored the very real consequences of globalization that can occur if you don't do it in a way where you're protecting workers and preparing them so that they can adjust and still have a fair chance of competition in the market. We want to thank everybody for listening to the presentation today. We're delighted to dive into the discussion and questions. As Andres noted earlier, you can buy Reclaiming Populism from Pages of Hackney, LSE's official bookshop, which there's a link to in the chat. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Paul. If you haven't done it, go out and buy the book. I have it right here. Lots of food for thought there. You know, this is a fascinating subject. Clearly you touched on some important points. I am itching to ask a few questions, but I will be disciplined. And before I do that, I'm going to hand it over to my friend and colleague, Vanessa Rubio, who knows a thing or two about populism out there in the real world. After Vanessa's remarks, I will ask a question or two, and then we will open it up to the audience. Vanessa, thank you very much for joining us. Floor is yours.
On the contrary, thank you, Andres. Thank you, Dean. Thank you, Eric. And thank you, Paul, for this wonderful, thought-provoking book. There is a most needed shedding of new light on an old phenomenon, populism, which, by the way, is absolutely quite current, as we can see across the world. So you propose and very well support throughout the book a new thesis, which implies that we have a wrong diagnosis on what exactly causes angry, desperate, dissatisfied, hopeless, frustrated and indeed disenchanted voters to run to the arms of populisms, electorally speaking. So mainstream thinking and mainstream policies, as you well pointed out, and politics tend to think it's inequality to blame. And you're telling us it is not, that it is the lack of economic fairness and social mobility. And I tend to agree from my own practical experience. Actually, what we can see here is that by just focusing on reducing inequality almost as the only paradigm has indeed diverted very valuable resources, very valuable time, and at the same time, leaving people as unhappy and as unsatisfied as they were since the beginning. So this is what frustrates many policymakers and politicians, because you can still argue that there had been some limited still, but some advances in relation to reducing inequality in across the world. But I'm talking about the story prior to COVID, because of course COVID meant a huge regression in this regard. But this is something that has us questioning why, despite these advances, are still people angry, dissatisfied, and why are we not meeting their needs? And you give us an answer to that. And the answer would be because people don't care so much about the other's performance, about what others have, even if they might have a lot. What they really care about is their day-to-day lives, a more practical answer, no? Which is, what do they themselves lack? And what opportunities they don't have access to? And what they perceive, and I think it's also a very important concept, as an unfair reward to their effort. So I would say that instead of looking into a more sort of collective explanation of that discontent, we should look into like a more individualistic and pragmatic vision of the lack of a conducive environment, indeed, in the one hand, but the lack of concrete elements that make individuals advance economically, no, and have social mobility. And what you mentioned, not being, you know, having the idea that you are condemned to live in the same precarious conditions that you were born to, no? That you have expectations, that you have hope, that you have tangible possibilities of materializing improvement and to have a better life, no? So it is not this other discussion, a very widespread discussion about going after the rich, no, or going after the uber rich. There's this recent report by Oxfam and the Institute for Policy Studies that propose taxing extreme wealth, no? So we should be mindful of that because of course, in the one hand, it's not linear, no? You don't get more income and immediately end poverty or end lack. And it's not the sort of Robin Hood approach, but rather a one that focuses on the lacks, on equal opportunities, no? So I find that quite revealing. And from what I experienced back in the day when I was deputy minister of social development in particular, I can assure you that people want to feel capable, want to be capable. They want to own their own destiny. They go to the free food places because they have no other option, but not because they want to go there, no? They extend the hand to so you can give them the proper elements to build a house. But again, they don't want to do that. They want to have their own elements, their own possibilities to be the owners of their destiny. So when I looked into the paradigm you propose, and I am aware that you propose it for the developed world, in particular for 4 countries. But when I was looking to try to extrapolate it to the developing and emerging countries, we can definitely find answers and find a lot of similarities there. Because I think it would be very interesting, as you propose, to have in the one hand the growth diagnostics paradigm to address the main questions that prevent people to have social fairness and economic fairness. But on the other hand, it made me also think about the paradigm of multidimensional poverty. So if you would mix them both, you would have in the one hand the multidimensional approach to economic fairness, and in the other hand, a sort of social mobility diagnostics, no? So you would have the multidimensional approach to economic fairness to ensure the policies that you need to have security, food and nutrition, health, education, social security, housing, services to housing. But then in the other hand, you would have the social mobility diagnostics to find the binding constraints to social mobility. And there you would find issues such as, or policies such as infrastructure, bridging the digital gap, clean and efficient energy matrix, higher education or lifelong training and learning for all, but also policies and regulations aimed at, for instance, preventing discrimination or promoting competition. No, so that I think absolutely makes sense for again for developing and emerging economies. So I don't want to go any further. A very captivating book, a must read for policy analysts, for policymakers, for politicians. And we really need to reconsider the widespread vision of the reasons behind the very legitimate discontent and disenchantment of large parts of our populations. I would end on two comments that perhaps are two questions, but two challenges, I would say. One of them is measuring more subjective concepts like economic fairness and just retribution, because they are linked to perception. So that's a question I had throughout the reading of the book. And also accommodating the very real and very powerful and very legitimate narrative against elites, privilege, corruption, and abuse. So how do you make sense of this in the context of all your premises? Thank you so much. Congratulations. And go buy the book, students.
Thank you, Vanessa. Thank you, everyone. Again, great subject, lots of food for thought. Let me propose we do the following thing. Paul and Eric may need a minute to reflect on what Vanessa has said. So while they do that, I'm going to add sort of my two cents here to the discussion and then hand it over to them so that we can get a reaction from both of the authors of the book. I am very sympathetic to the idea that a mechanical link between inequality and populism is completely insufficient to deal with the complexities of the problem. For a number of reasons, which I don't really have the time to go into, but in particular, you know, I am not a professional statistician or econometrician, but I'm enough of an economist to understand that if I want to expect the evolution of a variable, and that variable is going up, disenchantment is going up, frustration is going up, unrest is going up, support for populism is going up, well, then those are fairly sudden and fairly sharp changes. I need to resort to a variable that also has been rising. And in particular, it may be the case that inequality has risen in the US and in the UK, but it is not true that inequality has risen in many other places in which populism went up. Populism is the name of the game in Mexico, Vanessa's home country. And Mexico is an unequal country, but the Gini coefficient fell during the commodity boom. The same is true in Peru, the same is true in Chile, the same is true in many countries that are today wrestling with populism. It is also true in countries in which populism is ripe. I'm thinking of Turkey, I'm thinking of the Philippines. These are countries in which, of course, there are plenty of economic problems, but it is not obvious that you can draw the mechanical link between economic failure, rise in populism, and a rise in inequality. Now, having said that, I am tempted to ask of you sort of the same question, because it sounds right to me at a sort of intuitive level. And if I do a little introspection, you know, I've been a politician, I've been out there, and I can kind of flash through my head the kinds of complaints that people voice when a politician running for office, you know, stops and talks to voters on a street corner. You know, typically people don't say, oh, you know, I read in a World Bank report the Gini coefficient went up, so I'm voting for the opposition. That's not a common occurrence. But people do say, I've been mistreated. I've been treated, you know, without fairness. I applied for a job and I didn't get it, but some other guy got it because, you know, he had the right last name or came from the right school or And the, by right school, I don't mean a good school. I mean just, you know, a posh school, or you know, sometimes people will complain that a party had got the job, but I didn't, even though I had a better CV. And of course, there are many kinds of kind of violation of that sense of fairness. It could be prejudice, it could be racial discrimination, it could be gender discrimination, it could be a million things, right? But to be fair to the argument, I think you have to show, and maybe you are prepared to show, but I didn't hear it from Paul and from Eric, that if populism is a result of a sense of economic unfairness, well, population is the extent, the popularity of populism, if you want to put it that way, has gone up a lot. So can we show empirically that, in fact, you know, unfairness in the way that you define it has gone up? And where, you know, is that the case in the US and the UK? Could one extend those measures of unfairness to the Brazils and Mexicos, you know, the Turkeys and Philippines, the Indias and Poland of the world? Or are emerging markets maybe in a different cup of tea and, you know, you need a different explanation? And similarly, I will ask this last question, and then I will hand it back to you guys. Is it the case that we understand why the sense of unfairness has triggered a certain right-wing populism? Because naively, if I didn't know much about the subject, I would have said, "Oh, people are feeling unfairly treated." You know, there are situations in which the hardworking, productive person didn't get the job or didn't get the higher reward, and the, you know, the person who didn't deserve it did. Well, one naive reaction might be to say, okay, well, unfairness is typically a claim of the left, right? It is people on the left that go around saying life is unfair. People on the right typically say, oh, life is fair. It's just the market that is handing out the goods, right? So if unfairness is at the core of all of this, real unfairness or perceived unfairness, why is populism of the right having a heyday instead of populism of the left? This is not true across the world. You know, Peru has a left populist government. Mexico has a left populist government. But in the Turkeys and the United States and the Britons and the Philippines and Brazil and India, you know, these are right-wing populists. So why the prediction, or what explains this empirical link? And why is it wrong to think that unfairness automatically should have led people to vote for Jeremy Corbyn? But they didn't vote for Jeremy Corbyn, right? What am I missing in that story? Enough from me. And again, thank you very much, everybody. And let me go back to, I don't know if Paul or Eric would like to, you know, react, and in which order. You're free to do it, both of you guys. And then we will move to Q&A with the audience. So why don't you take 2 or 3 minutes each to respond, or, you know, or add any additional elements you think are worth considering. And then we will have a Q&A.
We have a tried and true method. We let Eric go first, and then I fill in.
All right. All right.
Excellent. So we had four questions, one on measuring subjective perceptions of fairness, one on the perception of sort of corrupt elites, one on the timeline of populism and the need for an observation of rising economic unfairness to explain that, and then the question of why populism is mostly right-wing. So let's answer those one at a time, or I'll try to. So first of all, about measuring subjective perceptions of unfairness, there certainly are, you know, some variables that do try to capture that. One which we use in the quantitative analysis behind the book that we like is from the Gallup World Poll, where they simply ask, you know, in all these different countries around the world, do you have confidence in national government? It's just a yes and no answer, but it's really nice because it's internationally comparable. We've used it, other researchers have used it, like Sergey Guriev, for example. So that's one way you can get at it. But I think there's also sort of a more personal flavor to it, in that the way that fairness and unfairness can play out, even though it can be driven by these common perceptions of, you know, I'm not having a fair go, I'm not getting what I deserve, there's definitely also different cultural contexts in which it occurs. The reaction in, you know, some parts of the world is maybe one way of looking at it is Andres's last point, that in some parts of the world it's left wing, and in some parts of the world it's right wing. In Greece and Mexico, you have left-wing populism, maybe because of the local context there. And in other parts, it's much more right-wing and pro-free markets and xenophobia. So there are interesting questions of how you measure that. Generally, we try to use uniform measures in our quantitative research, though, just because it's more tractable. With regard to perceptions of corruption, that's a key part of it, because people see this unfairness that exists, not just as the politicians have failed at policy, they see it as the system is being rigged by corrupt elites. That's a really critical part of that. And there are huge gaps in perception across different countries about elites. For example, people in Sweden have very positive views of billionaires, and much more positive views of billionaires than in the United States, in spite of the fact that billionaires in Sweden hold a larger, hold more wealth as a share of GDP. And one piece of evidence for that might be that there's much more rent seeking in the US that explains that wealth. So there's certainly an element of it there. I think that any political strategy, maybe it shouldn't go off the rails declaring, all of the elites, we just gotta lock them up or whatever, but there's definitely an anger that in some cases, you can think of the global financial crisis might be justified. Paul, do you have anything to say about those first two questions?
Keep going. I'm going to speak more to Vanessa's points.
Sorry?
I'm going to speak more to Vanessa's points.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, I'll go ahead with the other two questions from Andres then. One about how a rising variable ought to explain the timeline of populism. Mm. So the first thing that we want to clarify is that there's a lot of confusion in the popular discussion about the timeline of populism. People tend to see it as this, bolt from the blue in 2016, where you have Brexit and you have Trump, and then, it goes on, and Marine Le Pen in 2017, et cetera, et cetera. But in fact, there's quite a lot of evidence that the underlying tension leading to populism has been building since at least the 1990s. You can see that, for example, even in electoral results, where you can look at results for UKIP and the Brexit Party have been building up since the 1990s very much. Similar, long-term support for the Front National, or I guess now Rassemblement National in France, rising polarization in the United States. So there is a longer time frame there. The other thing that we would say is that there, to begin with, is a contentious discussion about whether social mobility has in fact been getting worse in and of itself. There is certainly evidence in both directions, but what we argue in the book in particular is that you can have an underlying system of really bad social mobility, and then when it gets hit with the wrong kinds of shocks, it just accelerates things like crazy. If you have a system where you have low social mobility and people can't get ahead on their own merits, and then they get knocked down by globalization and they get knocked down by the global financial crisis, it makes the underlying problems that were there to begin with much, much worse. And, as we showed in the presentation, there certainly is evidence that things like financial crises can lead to those problems in those ways. Finally, to answer the question of populism, why populism is mostly right wing. We argue that the reason this plays out is for exactly the reason, Andres, you said. It's not that people read a report and say, oh, the Gini coefficient is going up, I better vote for a populist. It's that they feel that, they're being threatened, that they're being held back. And the natural human reaction, however flawed, is to turn inward to your community and look for people that you trust very personally as a source of group protection. And as a consequence of that, populism very quickly gets identitarian. You get the sort of xenophobic, inward-looking flavors of right-wing populism and say, it's just the foreigners and we need to just band together and protect ourselves. And that's something that is anathema to the left's entire, way of being. Paul, do you want to jump in with thoughts on Vanessa's question?
Yeah, I thought, so I ran for parliament twice. Thankfully, I didn't win. It was so interesting being a candidate as opposed to being a politician. But when I ran the first time in 2006, I was asked if I was a feminist, which, you've got to manage those kind of questions intelligently and carefully. And I said, well, it depends on your definition of what a feminist is. And this speaks, Vanessa, to your first point. And that is that I felt that women should be able to live as much as possible their lives on their own terms, and that it was up to the society to provide the tools to do that. And in that expression, there was men were also liberated. So it was the whole society was lifted up. And at the time, what I was arguing for was a national childcare strategy, that Canada did not have that, that there was obvious health benefits for the child and for the mother. But in fact, there were massive economic benefits, because I ran a number of businesses and often experienced the 32, 33, 34-year-old professional woman who had been going at 150 miles an hour and was doing great, who all of a sudden, I'm pregnant or I have a child and now I don't know what to do. I've got one woman had to resign because she had a 25-minute gap in her childcare strategy. So this goes back to what people really crave. What they crave is a chance to live their life as much as possible on their own terms. And so when we look at equal opportunity, we think about, okay, what are the policies that we can put in to deliver that? The second question was about how people react to wealth. So we gave a presentation at INET, Professor Bonhoeffer, and we were asked very aggressively after we had made the case for fair, unequal outcomes, that how could we possibly not think that, you know, Jeff Bezos and Amazon was like the worst thing in the world, and why wouldn't we just like tax them out of existence with all the other billionaires? And we said, well, we have a framework to understand that. If Amazon's success was because of monopoly capitalism, then by all means, go after them and do everything you can. If Jeff Bezos didn't pay taxes, avoided his taxes, then by all means, go after him. But if the evidence of what he achieved and the wealth that he created was achieved fairly, then the more power to him. And that's because everyone would like to be Jeff Bezos. And we start off our book with a quote by Lucy Kellaway, the wonderful journalist from the FT, who left a very lucrative, very high profile journalist position, columnist position at the FT, to go and teach children in Tower Hamlets math. And she took a cohort of these kids, 15 kids, to the most expensive hotel in London, £15,000 a night for a penthouse. And she was generally surprised that every single one of them thought that that was just great. And gee whiz, they would really like to stay there too. And if they had the money that Jeff Bezos would stay, they would do the same thing. Mm-hmm. So it's a very simple thing, giving people the tools they need to live their life on their own terms and creating the market mechanisms to make that possible.
All right. Thank you very, very much. We could carry on. I'm sure Vanessa has a few things that she would like to say, but you know, I will, if you'd like to come back and participate again, Vanessa, you're more than welcome to do so. But let me just pick up a couple of questions here from the chat. The first question that pops up is one by Sir Vince Cable, who's a visiting professor here at School of Public Policy, and of course used to be the leader of the Lib Dems in the UK Parliament. And Vince's question actually is not unrelated to what I asked earlier. And the question reads, if inherited wealth is a source of discontent, why is inheritance taxation one of the most unpopular taxes? I think that fits very nicely with the discussion we've been having. You know, if unfairness is the problem, then people might want sort of technocratic cures for unfairness. And, you know, it may be fair or unfair, I don't know, to say that the Donald Trumps of the world are really not providing any cures for unfairness. But as you pointed out, maybe we don't want cures, maybe just want to feel good. And how do we feel good? Well, we seek refuge in our little tribe. And perhaps that is what populism is mostly about. But I don't want to put words in.
I'll put something there. Well, first of all, of course, we all want to pass on everything we have to our kids and to our children's children. Everyone wants to do that, no matter if you have, £3 in your pocket or a billion. You want to give as much as you can.
Right.
But the fact is that inheritance taxes are probably an important way to manage the challenge of low social mobility and create higher levels of social mobility. And a very good example is Japan. So Japan and the social mobility measurements, it's in our book. We've got a graph that shows all the different countries. It's kind of middling in terms of social mobility, and has had a lot of economic challenges over the last, you know, 30 years. And we get often asked, partly because I spent 15 years in Japan and I did my PhD at the University of Tokyo, you know, why doesn't Japan have a populist problem? And there's many reasons. One is they have a catch-all political party that captures a lot of the discontent. But the other reason is they have quite a progressive tax system to such an extent that a lot of foreigners who worked in Japan arranged their taxes so they didn't pay Japanese taxes because they were so onerous. But they have very, very punitive, if you want to use that word, or progressive, if you want to use that word, inheritance taxes. And so this takes some of the sting out of the mobility challenges that Japan has. My point would be, and Vince would probably know this much better than me, but how do you frame an inheritance tax strategy and policy in terms of fairness? Canada, for example, is going to have a big issue around this because of the extraordinary historic rise in housing prices. This has created enormous tension in Canada. And this is going to be playing out over the next 10 to 15 years, because quite frankly, if you don't have a house, your children are probably going to have a very difficult time getting on the property ladder. So, and of course, like in many countries, not the UK, mind you, there's no tax on the capital gain on a principal home that you're living in. So this is a very important issue. But again, it's not the only issue. You have to look at the whole structure of the tax system. I mean, you go back to the Warren Buffett quote that he paid lower tax, effective tax rate than his secretary did. That speaks to economic unfairness.
Right. I take your points, Paul, but you know, I Vince may want to come in again on this, but I still find it a little bit puzzling that if unfairness is the problem, there's so much opposition, and particularly the North Atlantic countries, the US and the UK, to what in Europe or elsewhere might be a natural tax reform. You know, we've had many discussions on the fact that, you know, the billionaires in the US pay so little tax, and there's not much political impetus to change that. Maybe Biden will do something about it, but you know, even the Democrats in power today don't have unanimity on that, and there are a number of sort of conservative Democrats who oppose that, and they do so not because of any great deal of principle. They do so because they're looking at the polls, and the polls don't seem to make that a very sexy alternative, particularly if you come from the Midwest or the South in the U.S. But I don't want to stay on that point. Maybe we'll come back to it. There are plenty of questions here, and I do want to give the audience a chance to come in. So let me read a question from Kevin Ryan, who's in France. And Kevin says, in the European context, right-wing populism typically comes in hand with nationalism. In your story, are nationalism and populism basically just two sides of the same coin, or is nationalism a separate phenomenon?
So I would say that as we sort of touched on a little bit earlier, this comes to the point to an extent of why is it that right-wing nationalist, even xenophobic, arguably, populism is so prevalent. You know, there are some left-wing exceptions, but generally speaking, that's the main form of populism that has played out. And, you know, we haven't written a book about nationalism specifically. We've written it about populism. So I don't want to say anything that's going to be a catch-all for all forms of nationalism. But what I will say is that we certainly think that the economic unfairness that drives populism can often lead it to take a nationalistic flavor. And again, it's because of that sense that you and your community are being treated unfairly because of your identity. You're not getting the opportunities you deserve. You're not getting the rewards you deserve. The same thing is true of your family, of your neighbors, and it causes you to be very inward looking, and you know, blame foreigners even if they aren't really there. There was you know, a great quote in The Economist a couple of years ago where they interviewed some East German populists about their views on immigration, and the people being interviewed essentially said that it's not that we're racist. Please don't call us racist. It's that we feel like we're being left out while you're helping foreigners. So we would say that that's the causal argument there, at least with regard to populism.
And what one of the points we make very clearly in the first chapter is that the other arguments for populism, like immigration or social media, the China shock, these amplify an existing problem. So the necessary condition, as Philip McCann said, the necessary indicator is low social mobility. The illiberal politician uses these other things to amplify the challenge, to amplify the discontent. And that's why they're often conflated, or that's why analysis tends to look at the amplifiers rather than the initial cause. So the key is to get the diagnosis right at the beginning. It's low social mobility.
Let me carry on with some questions here from the chat, but Vanessa, please, if you'd like to come in, just do so. Act like a populist, seize the microphone. Josh Turner, who's a politics student here at the LSE, I think has an interesting question, which is about sort of the consequences of having populists do what they claim they will do. You know, Josh points out that Boris Johnson, presumably a populist leader in the UK, has a leveling up agenda. So suppose that he in fact succeeded in leveling up so that people in the North felt that they were no longer being treated unfairly. Is that good or bad for populism in the UK? You could imagine that, you know, that would make Boris Johnson more popular. At the same time, you could argue that if a sense of unfairness is at the root cause of the problem, if you get rid of the root cause, then you get rid of the political phenomenon of populism. What do we say to Josh?
Go ahead, Eric, and then I'll jump in.
I was going to say, first of all, that if you were to completely eliminate, you know, the regional unequal opportunity in the UK, you might see less support for parties like UKIP. But I think you have to balance the potential negative effects against, you know, a quasi-populist figure like Johnson, against the very real gratitude that people might feel if he actually pulled leveling up off in all the right ways. I mean, you know, people very much have a sense that they're being ignored, or that they have been ignored, that they're not getting the opportunities they deserve. So I think if a leader and a party actually delivered on that, and populists do talk about a rigged system and lift behind people, if they actually delivered on that, I think they could take that to the bank.
Right.
The first presentation that we made was to Onward UK.
Okay.
Which is Michael Gove's think tank. Sure. You know, we sent out a number of emails, well, Eric did, you know, about and they jumped all over us. This was in November, before the book was, just when the book was published in the UK.
And so what kind of reception did you get from Gove's people?
Very warm. This is a very important way to think about what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. They had not really put fairness at the center. They just hadn't thought, I mean, they were talking about that, but they hadn't used that word. And so it's been a very warm, Nick Timothy was on, was very, very supportive of what we were arguing.
Very good. Warm and Gove are not two words that one hears often in the same sentence.
He wasn't there. Okay. It was Will Tanner who runs Onward UK, but I'm sure he heard about it.
Yes, of course. Yeah. So let me carry on here with some really good questions that we have. So far, we've been talking about sort of frustration with the economic side of life, with fairness, with rewards, with employment, wages, etc. D. Butler, there's no first name, so I don't know what the D stands for, is asking what I think is a good question. Maybe, and I'm paraphrasing here, the causes are not strictly economic. It's also frustration with political parties. So it's sort of a political unfairness more than purely economic unfair. Particularly, might it be that people are frustrated that political parties seem beholden to special interest groups and unresponsive to the public in general? Would you make that part of your unfairness syndrome, so to speak? And if so, where do we see it and how can we measure it?
Well, I would say that, you know, that's almost part of the problem of economic unfairness. I mean, you sort of have to ask, if you've got a situation like that, what's going wrong to begin with? You know, one possibility is just that the country has wrong ideas about how the economy should work. Another possibility definitely is that economic unfairness is in place because, you know, the governing parties are perhaps too beholden to special interests. And there definitely is a sense of frustration that occurs with that. I mean, look at the most famous example is the 2016 US presidential election and the calls to lock her up and the you know, sheer hatred, arguably, towards the Clintons, seen as these sort of, I don't know, parasitic elites. And so there definitely is, you know, this element of it that's a sense of the economy is unfair because the elites are rigging it to be so in their own favor.
Right. Very well, very well. Sarah Al-Harfan from London would like to know about the connection between technological changes and the phenomena that we're discussing. I imagine, you know, technology plays a role, and Sarah hints at this in several dimensions. One, clearly, you know, social media and that discussion, which you touch upon in the book, but we haven't talked about it much here. Secondly, technology has also changed the way that politicians and political entrepreneurs organize movements. You know, once upon a time, it was really hard to get people to come out at, you know, on a particular street corner, a particular time. You had to go knock on their doors. Nowadays, you just, you know, send a WhatsApp message to a group and there you have it. You're going to have 100,000 people come out at the same time. Last but not least, and Sarah says it here in her second question, clearly access to this technology is not uniform across countries. So maybe this determines a little bit how, you know, rich and poor countries developed and developing maybe reacting differently to the threat of populism. Any thoughts on tech or any of these aspects or other aspects?
It's absolutely,
which technology matters?
Yeah, it's absolutely at the center of our book. We speak very clearly about a phenomena, which is, you know, where does economic unfairness come from? And our argument is that technological change, environmental change, but technological change through history, if you look at particularly the last 200 years, results in a structural change in the economy. The structural change in the economy produces big winners and big losers. Mm-hmm. And that can take five, in the world we live in now, can take, say a generation and a half. Perhaps in the 1800s, it was 40 years. But it's a kind of a 20-year, 25-year process. Mm-hmm. The challenge is how does the political system react to that change? And that's what I think successful social democracy is all about, parliamentary democracy, that's the arena, that's the place where the policies begin to get developed to manage that change, because that change is inevitable when you have a market. You're going to have unequal outcomes. Mm-hmm. And that's driven by new technologies. The point is that in the last 35 years, our politicians, for the most part, were persuaded that the market was always right. The people you would expect to have developed policies that would have dealt with the fallout from new technologies and economic change, people like Tony Blair, people like Bill Clinton, people like Paul Martin, They were persuaded by the neoliberal argument, you know, rooted in the Chicago School, Milton Friedman, that, you know, government maybe isn't all the problem, but it's a large part of it, to get out of the way and let the markets do what they want. And so the political system has not adjusted to the deep economic change that's happened, particularly in places like the United States and in the UK. And what's interesting, Eric, and I write about a piece of research that shows the different ability for Canadians and Americans to result to the China shock. The China trade shock was much more of a challenge for Canada. And on the whole, Canadians were able to adjust because of public policy support around healthcare, mm-hmm. around education and other things. So technology changes the structure of the economy. It creates big winners and losers. And then the question is, does your political system adjust? And that is a 2025. And if it doesn't adjust, then you create a hereditary elite. Mm-hmm. And all the evidence is that they can stay in power for a long time until they're gotten rid of, usually violently. So the technology question is absolutely central.
Thank you. Very well. We are beginning to get close to the end of our allotted time, but maybe we have time for one or two more questions from the audience, and then I will hand it back to all three of you, maybe beginning with Vanessa, if she'd like to add something, and then we will give Paul and Eric sort of a closing minute, like in presidential debates, you know. Give us your final message. But before we do that, let me read a question from a recent LSE School of Public Policy graduate, Konstantinos Chouvalas, whom I know well. He took my class last year. Clearly he was a good student because he's asking me very pointed and precise and technical questions. Constantino says, if I'm going to take social mobility as a predictor of populism, is it the level of social mobility or is it the change or the trend in social mobility that matters? I guess this is connected to my initial question. You know, if social mobility hasn't changed much over the last 25 years, you know, why now? So you have to tell me whether it's, you know, the rate of change in one direction or another that matters, or maybe the sensitivity has changed, even though social mobility itself has not changed. So that's question number one. And question number two is a more general one, but it's also trying to get you guys to be precise about measurement here. So if economic unfairness is behind the rise in populism, what is the best cross-country measure of unfairness? Is it simply stunted social mobility, or is it something else that we can go gather data on and sort of do our statistical estimation?
Perfect. So to address the first of those concerns about, you know, is it the level or is it the change? In the paper, we look at the level, and part of that is just for reasons of tractability. There isn't very good data on changes in social mobility in lots of parts of the world. Part of it, though, or rather part of the argument, though, is that to begin with, there certainly is some evidence that social mobility has been getting worse in different countries around the world. There's evidence, for example, in the US that the income level of your parents has become a more decisive determinant of income inequality, as opposed to, you know, other factors such as even race or what have you. And then part of it as well is that a system of low social mobility sets up a large degree of vulnerability to economic unfairness. And then we argue that that can be exacerbated by further shocks to the system, such as globalization and the global financial crisis. And that perhaps also speaks to the second of the questions about how do we measure economic unfairness? Now, as you know, perhaps you can infer in the book and the research behind it, we've used social mobility because it is a convenient variable that has pretty good international coverage. It's not the only type of important economic unfairness. You can look, for example, at research on the global financial crisis and how that created a system where you had you know, people losing a lot of money because of the arguably self-interested actions of a narrow elite. In addition to that, I would say, though, that something that is somewhat restrictive to an extent about social mobility is that it only looks at how your parents' income is a predictor of your own success. It doesn't look at other factors like the geography of where you were born or your ethnicity or things like that. And there are other income inequality decomposition techniques that can address that. The data is sparse, but maybe there will be more in the future.
Great, thank you. I'm going to bring up one last question and then we will go for our closing minute, all three of you. Max Clark, an LSE student social policy writing from New York, is interested in how sort of generalizable this hypothesis is to countries which are not the US and the UK. And there's one fact that Vanessa and I have mentioned already. Clearly, populism is not simply Trump and Boris. India, Brazil, the Philippines, Turkey, Mexico, and a number of others have also gone populist. So question number one is, does your model apply to these instances of populism in the emerging market world, or do we need a different model? And then connected to that, this is question number two. It is striking that there's a fair bit of populism in countries where, you know, economic opportunity is pretty well spread around. Scandinavia, you know, with Denmark experiencing a surge in populism, with the Swedish Democrats having acquired 20% of the vote. So again, for Scandinavia, is this a good model, or do we need a different model to think about that particular experience?
Okay, so to address the first of those questions, the data analysis that goes into the book is entirely with respect to high-income countries. That being said, we think that the arguments that we make about economic unfairness are to an extent universal. People get frustrated when they feel like they're not being treated fairly. Maybe there's an avenue for future research expanding this to the context of developing countries, but it's certainly something that we think could contribute in those circumstances. Second, there was a question about, for example, the Scandinavian countries. And we have a whole section in the book that actually addresses those specifically, because it is a question that comes up frequently. And we would say that we argue that what having high social mobility and a fair economy does is it doesn't make you 100% immune to populism. It gives you a firewall against populism. It makes you resistant to it so that it won't just overrun the system. So, arguably what happened in the Scandinavian countries was the 2015 European migrant crisis happened. Mm-hmm. It was a huge shock to the system. You had unprecedented levels of refugees and migrants coming in and people sort of freaked out. But at the same time, it was very, very important that this problem could not be as easily connected to the perceptions of a unfair system where people were already feeling left behind. And then there was the additional issue of, helping these migrants and these refugees at the expense of people struggling in the home country. That was less of arguably less of a serious issue in the Scandinavian countries. And as a consequence of that, there hasn't been anything like Brexit or Trump. And if you look at indicators of support in national government, it's pretty good. And even if you look at the 2019 European Parliament election, for example, Denmark had a vote share for populists of 10%, I believe, and for Sweden, it was 13%. Whereas in places like France and Italy and the UK, it ranged from like 33% to 55%. So there is quite a significant gulf there in the extent to which these countries can just be overrun by populism if they have a firewall of fairness that protects it against them, or they don't.
To use the phrase of the time, high social mobility inoculates you against the risk of a populist eruption. There's always going to be populist potential moments, a refugee crisis, an economic shock, but high levels of social mobility makes it much more difficult for politicians, leaders who are liberal in their instincts, left or right, to amplify that into a change in the system.
I suppose the word inoculation makes me want to ask, is it enough to have one jab of fairness?
No, or it's not.
Do you need a third booster shot?
How
much is enough?
Well, that's a very good point, because the whole point about technological change and the change in the structure of the economy and the ability of the political system to adjust is that fairness is a moving target. Even countries with high level of social ability today, I think Canada is going to be a real test case over the next 15 to 20 years. You have to keep this in front of you at all times.
Absolutely. Well, some countries are going for the fourth booster shot. Maybe we all need a bit of that when it comes to fairness. Okay, everybody, this has been wonderful. We're going to do one closing round and we will call it a day. We have about 3 minutes left and three speakers. Vanessa, why don't you take a minute to add some parting thoughts?
Thank you. Maybe just something that I have been thinking through the discussion. We really need to not see this discussion on economic fairness and social mobility as merely transactional against populism or populist temptations.
Yes.
And maybe we should move towards a more deeper structural discussion on whether this is linked, I am sure it is, with better quality growth and well-being in general. So I think we should broaden the scope of the discussion we have just had here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very well put, Vanessa, and a very, very important point.
Why don't you let Eric go and then I'll finish.
Wonderful.
Sure. I mean, I would completely agree with you, Vanessa. Creating a fair economy, and I hope this comes across in the book, is not just about inoculating against populism. It's about creating a society in which people are happy to live and can live life as much as possible on their own terms. It's a goal in and of itself. I guess to close up, I want to say thank you so much to Vanessa, to Andres, to everybody who's listened in on this conversation and helped support it technically. We'd be delighted if you bought the book at Pages of Hackney, LSE's official independent bookshop. Feel free also to get in touch with us. You can email me. I'll put my email in the chat. It's eprotzer@hks.harvard.edu.
Yeah, well,
thank you, Eric. Paul, the last word is yours.
Yeah, just echo what Eric said. Our book's on a journey. It's into its fourth year in terms of a project and thinking about it. And I can't tell you how helpful it has been today to have your comments, the questions, and certainly Vanessa's insights, both of you bringing kind of a practical understanding of this problem, is incredibly helpful for us. And we look forward to looping back over the next 18 months as we hope our book gains some traction. We've tried to change the conversation about populism, but what we really want to do is change how politicians think about the policies they need to make at a better world for all of us.
All right. Thank you very much, everyone. It seems to me that as parting thoughts, I could summarize two things that just got said. One is Vanessa's and Eric's very valuable point, namely, we should be talking about fairness not simply as the cure to the Donald Trumps of the world. We should be talking about fairness because fairness is important in itself. And of course, Paul is absolutely right. Populism is not going away anytime soon. So we still, need to refine the ways we think about it and the ways we reclaim voters from the populist temptation. That conversation will be ongoing, and we would be delighted to have Eric, Paul, and of course my colleague Vanessa in a further discussion on these very important topics. So with that, I will say yet one more time that the book is available, can be purchased at Pages of Hackney, and I hope to see many of you in the near future at another LSE School of Public Policy event. Good evening, everyone, and see you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.